Good morning. Hawaii's primary is over. Eyes are squarely on the general election. But with so much attention on the presidential race, we asked public administration scholar Morgan Johansson which level of government really is affecting the lives of most people. And as new technologies continue to shape Hawaii's growth, what opportunities did we miss, and which ones might give Hawaii an innovation advantage? A panel this week considers that question. We'll talk with futurist Jim Dater. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkoot. Musician Ernie Provencher doubles down with his double bass, a demonstration of that instrument's versatility, live in our studio. And Ido Natasha's feature film Popolo looks at a martial arts master's efforts to start a studio in Hawaii.
It's Monday, August 15th. That's The Conversation. Now the news. Good morning and welcome to a Monday and a brand new week. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. This is The Conversation. And to my right, Chris Vanderkoot.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
I think maybe a lot of young people these days are wondering if they're preparing for jobs that will soon no longer exist.
Well, right, exactly. And when we talk about what they're learning in school, and we talk a lot about STEM, and we talk a lot about STEAM, which is the science, technology, engineering, and math with a little bit of arts and social sciences in the mix. But most people would say, isn't that supposed to be a basic education?
Well, who would know?
Well, we're going to talk about that this morning and what that means as we go forward in our state. Now, we routinely are told that jobs held by people right now will one day soon be automated. There's no debate about how technology has shaped modern life. There is plenty of conversation about how technology will continue to shape the future. In Hawaii, that conversation will be at the heart of a panel discussion this week. It will consider opportunities Hawaii failed to understand not that long ago, and, more importantly, what innovation can move Hawaii into a reimagined future. One man whose name is often synonymous with future studies is former Professor Jim Dater. He's on the line now. Good morning. Good to talk to you again.
Good morning.
As we have been told for a very long time that at the nexus of growth and opportunity, squarely you see technology. But Hawaii has been trying to support a climate of innovation now for many years. Where do you peg the state's efforts?
Well, I think that there are two ways to look at this. One is we've actually done a pretty good job considering our size and our location and the sorts of resources we have and don't have. Another is that we have missed, we have known intellectually that there were economic opportunities that for one reason or another we failed to grasp and materialize.
What would those be?
Well, the main thing that I'd like to point out is that in 1970, a long time ago, there was a widespread activity called Hawaii 2000, in which citizens looked ahead. And there was a task force on science and technology. Let me just quote one series of sentences from the book called Hawaii 2000. So this is in 1970. We predict that improved equipment and simpler technologies for computer information storage and retrieval will lead to generations of personalized, pocket-sized computers. Through these, the individual citizens will have instant access to vast stores of knowledge. It's already clear that the source of power in the world of today and the future is largely through the access to information, as it was once through the control of land and then of raw material supplies and manufacturing facilities. I don't see how you could have a clearer statement of what actually transpired than that. And yet, though we were warned, and even though the University of Hawaii at that time was, I think, unique in the world in having a satellite-based communication technology called PSAT, we certainly were not one of the states to lead in the development of either the hardware hardware or software of electronic technology that we should have.
Amazing to think that that came out in 1970, and people listening to that and thinking how long ago that was, and clearly what we all walk around with in our pockets or purses right now. But it also says, though, that we tend to be a little slow on the uptake. And that's not universally true, you know, with everybody. Some people are really, really good early adopters. But in general, with the state being a little bit slower on the uptake, what do you think now is, the biggest limitation to getting to where technology may take us in the next 40 years?
Well, let me first of all respond a little bit about history, because, as I say, I think we're not as bad as some people think we are, or as good as we should have been. But it seems to me that the lesson to be learned there is that we can't decide whether we want to be local and focus on local self-sustainability, which I think is a very good thing for us to do, or whether we want to be global and assume that the global economic system that has worked so well over the last several hundred years will continue or not. And that's the big question at the present time. It seems to me that, if nothing else, the current presidential election is indicating that not only in the United States, but elsewhere in the world, the future of governance and of the sort of political economic system that we've known for the recent past is uncertain. And then the technologies that you mentioned in the opening, electronic communication technologies, are indeed already, to a large extent, in my opinion, responsible for the economic problems we have now and are going to continue to challenge. So we are in a situation where we no longer can have the certainty about what technologies are important for the future and how we might be able to, in Hawaii, utilize them. So I wouldn't blame the state, either state officials or local culture or anything else, for the uncertainty we have here. It's universal, or should be universal, by anybody that's looking at the unusual situation we're in at the present time. That's what our panel is going to discuss. Mm-hmm. We have a variety of people from a variety of perspectives who are going to share their views about what they think the opportunities are ahead for the state.
As you mentioned, this idea of being very local and focusing on local needs versus and including sustainability and food security, and also what it means to be part of the world. We're often told that that's very fluid, that one has to move from being very local into being a global citizen. But it seems that there seem to be barriers there. Is that so?
I don't think there are barriers, physical barriers or economic barriers. There might be psychological barriers. I have four children, and all of them have gone off to seek their fortune elsewhere, and all of them have come back to Hawaii for a variety of reasons. I don't blame them. I'd rather be in Hawaii than anywhere else in the world. That's why I'm here. And I think many of us very much want to take care of our homes and try to address the uncertainty, as well as being able to be part of the global economy. And I think that this, in fact, is possible and is what many people are doing. I know that from the point of view only of a business perspective, they want to be engaged in activities that are bringing ever-increasing profits to them. But frankly, I think the period of continued high economic growth is over, and we need to think more carefully about balancing global and local interests here in Hawaii.
That would also mean what kind of jobs will be necessary to do that. And right now, that seems to be a little bit uncertain as well.
I think that the high-tech future, the future of jobs, is extremely uncertain, as I indicated. I do not think that we are going to ever return to the sort of high physical employment by human beings, either in physical jobs or in mental jobs. Robotics and artificial intelligence have erased those jobs forever. They are not coming back, and in my opinion, are not going to be replaced by other jobs that require physical or mental labor on the part of humans. On the other hand, if we look at the enormity of challenges that are being brought on by environmental change, by climate change, by sea level rise, by the uncertainty of rainfall and so forth, I think that there are plenty of jobs in those areas which do require physical labor and are necessary for the security and safety of all of us here in Hawaii.
We've got to leave you for the moment, Dr. Dater, but thank you very much for the time that you spent with us this morning. We'll talk to you in the not-too-distant future. That's a promise.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Jim Dater is Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies. He will be on the panel entitled The Education to Work Pipeline Needed to Secure Hawaii's Future, coming up on Wednesday. For more information about it, look on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14. Coming up, Ernie Preventure and his double bass live in our studio. But first, your quiz.
In this morning's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about one of Hawaii's most remarkable public sites. It's the largest limestone cave in the islands and has provided researchers with vital information about Hawaii's past, well before humans lived here. The sediments that have accumulated inside the cave have an unusual chemical makeup, one that preserves almost anything that has fallen into the cave going back at least 10,000 years. That means a rich variety of both plant and animal fossils, including evidence of some 45 species of native birds and an underground ecosystem of blind cave-dwelling invertebrates. The microscopic samples found there are equally important to scientists. Those include tiny fossils, pollen, algae, plant spores, and DNA fragments. It's a scientific treasure trove that continues to yield new information, and this morning we're looking for its name. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and the first one to get the right answer gets our T-shirt.
Good morning, I'm William Self from TAG. I'm an actor. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The bass, in either its acoustic or electric incarnations, is an essential driver of the modern ensemble, present on every beat, anchoring the rhythm and the harmony all at once. Its capacity as a lead instrument, with its rich sonorities, is too often neglected, and Ernie Preventure and his band will remedy that oversight this Saturday in our Atherton studio. Ernie's here in our studio with his double bass. Good morning, Ernie.
Good morning, Chris.
By far the largest instrument we have yet brought into our studio. That's a personal best for us.
That's great. I'm setting a record with it.
Yeah. What made you choose the bass?
I started out as a guitar player. When I was a child, I remember I fell in love with the sound of a violin and a clarinet, and then guitar. I love the sound of guitar. So I took up the guitar, and when I was in high school and playing, and I kept hearing the bass guitar in rock music and funk music, I gravitated towards that. And shortly thereafter, once I got in touch with those low vibrations, I started listening to jazz and classical music, and I knew that the double bass was something to add to my arsenal. So that's how I went from guitar up to double bass.
And getting in touch with the low vibrations is really the key, because you reach a point where a good bass player can just sort of feel what needs to be done when music is moving 100 miles an hour.
That's correct. You can feel that, and you can feel the literal vibration because it rests against you when you play, and it's such a big box.
Yeah.
That when the note happens, you feel it.
You know, when I hear you in a jazz ensemble where you're walking a fast pizzicato pattern, and it's an up-tempo tune, how do you know what to play?
That's a good question. One thing is just a lot of experience playing things, and mostly being in the moment, because it is jazz, and it's all about being in the moment and trusting your instincts, and that's how it usually works. And if it's fast, staying relaxed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are the guidelines that you have? Let's say a chart is put in front of you with the chords to a song, and that's really the only information you have to work with aside from what's going on around you. What are the choices you make based on that?
The choices I make depend on what I see for the harmony that's there. In addition, obviously, to listening to what people are doing. Because as a bassist, a big thing I'm doing is supporting what the soloist is doing and finding a line between prodding the soloist, if I think that's the direction we might want to go in, or just totally support without any prodding at all. So that is a walking in line while I'm walking the line. But as far as looking at the chords, I just use my experience of understanding of harmony and what are the other options. Because sometimes when you see chords laid out on a chart, those are not the only way you're going to do it.
Right.
So you have you know that there's things you can do, or somebody else might play something that tells you where we're going to go now.
So if there's an alternative to the chord being played, you really need to sort of pick up on that in the moment.
That's correct. You want to pick up on it in the moment. Or you might even do it yourself in the moment. The bass player might do that adjustment to which everybody responds then in the moment.
Because, you know, you describe the difference between just strictly supporting and prodding a soloist. Strictly supporting might be just staying right on the bottom, the identifying notes of the chord.
That's correct.
And just sort of laying those down on the beat. And prodding the soloist might be making a little bit of a melodic suggestion based on the scale that's available.
Right, a melodic suggestion or a rhythmic polyrhythm, something that adds to the rhythmic excitement.
So you can, you've got a four to the floor, 1, 2, 3, 4 going on, and you might do a little triplet figure on top of that or something like that.
That's right.
Then get back on track.
That's right. Yeah,
makes sense.
Yep,
makes sense. Because it remains mysterious to me, Ernie, even after all these years.
Yeah.
Your concert is a celebration in a lot of ways of the capacity of the double bass as a melodic instrument.
That's true. Yes, I'm going to do that. I'm going to, in addition to playing the normal function of the bass, I'll be playing a lot of melodies and a lot of solo pieces accompanied by some of my friends. So in some cases, those will be jazz pieces, and in some pieces, they'll be classical pieces. So, for example, I'll play Rachmaninoff's Vocalise accompanied by guitar, and I'll play the Eccles Sonata, which is a Baroque sonata accompanied by piano. So I have a lot of good friends. Ethan Capone's playing piano on this, David Yamasaki on guitar, Dwayne Padilla on violin. I have Sandy Sukiyama from KHBR here singing. And who did I forget? Oh, Rocky Holmes on saxophone and flutes joining me too. So we're going to play combinations of classical tunes, classical pieces, jazz tunes, and some of my original compositions.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the solo bass.
Okay. This is a tune of mine called Blues for Mr. Brown. Thank you.
You know, Ernie, even if you hadn't have told me the title, I would have probably guessed that that was about the great bassist Ray Brown, right?
Exactly right. Inspired by him and by his playing, as he inspired many bass players.
Well, it had that, you know, that beautiful, rich sonority that you identify with him, along with the bluesy feel. And I was noticing all the different ways you can hit a note. You slide up to the note, you put a vibrato on it. It's really, having no frets is really, opens up a lot of possibilities.
Yeah, it allows for a lot of expressive things you can do.
That's where that vocal quality comes
in. That's correct.
Sounded great, Ernie.
Thank you.
Ernie Preventure brings his double bass to the Atherton Studio on August 20th for a concert of classical music, jazz, and his own original jazz competitions. It's called Double Bass Doubles Down, performing duets, quartets, and sextets with Sandy Sukiyama, David Yamasaki, Rocky Holmes, Dwayne Padilla, and Ethan Capone.
HPR selects and purchases programs from National Public Radio, American Public Media, and many other content providers. Our station members have followed the money trail and realize that it starts and ends with them. Our thanks to these individuals, Jonathan Neary of Honolulu, Philip Kohlhammer of Kailua, and Wayne Smith of Kihei. We'd like to add your name to our membership rolls, too. You can call us at 955-8821 during business hours to find out more, or go online to hawaiipublicradio.org and sustain your public radio station. And thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Once, healthy ad revenue was the economic engine of the newspaper industry. As we've talked about for well over a decade, that revenue has plummeted in the past 16 years and newspaper jobs along with it. Despite the move to digital advertising, newspapers continue to pare down, and that includes at the Honolulu Advertiser. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Now, over the last week or so, we've been talking about what happened at Midweek and what's happening also at the Star Advertiser. It seems that this is one of those inevitable stories, that there really doesn't seem to be a way around it. Is there?
It doesn't appear to be. As Louis Kinnea reported, he talked to experts across the country, and one of them described it as no end in sight for the newspaper death spiral, and that includes McClatchy, Gannett, New York Times Company, and here at home, Oahu Publications, which in addition to the Star Advertiser and Midweek, it also has a near monopoly on newspapers across the state, every island except Maui. So this is the trend. It has hit home here, and we are going to see significant changes in the daily newspaper service here.
What do those changes look like, at least from what you're talking to people and what they're forecasting now?
Well, we do know that 8 non-union employees were let go from Midweek. It included the editor of Midweek, Don Chapman. They left 20 other positions vacant, unfilled. In terms of the Star Advertiser, we're looking at cuts in the unionized newsroom. We're expecting in the next few weeks to hear about that downsizing. It's happening through buyouts and job cuts. I haven't heard any specific names yet, but of course the concern for readership and frankly for Hawaii citizens is a loss of knowledge, of expertise, being able to serve readers of Hawaii as to what's going on in their community.
New York Times did this not too many months ago, where they announced that they would be doing buyouts in both the newsroom and the business departments. And they said to, you know, refocus on digital.
Right.
That seems to be what everybody's trying to do. But that digital revenue isn't exactly, you know, making up for the huge shortfall. Do we have any indication of what that shortfall is in Hawaii from the Star Advertiser?
There is definitely money to be made from digital, but unfortunately, big tech giants like Facebook and Google have been monopolizing the lion's share of that revenue, about 65%. As one journalism professor at UH said about the Star Advertiser, they seem to be moving slowly to the digital ad realm, not fast enough, not following the lead like New York Times and other companies. But in fact, that is the trend. That is where the money is.
No idea how much more money the Star Advertiser would have to make to be able to retain some more of its new staff.
Dennis Francis, the publisher, has been sort of quiet on those details. Obviously, that's something internal to the company. But he has indicated to our reporter that he feels that these cuts will help, that the company is financially sound and will continue to serve Hawaii.
All right, Chad, this one we'll be talking about for many more weeks to come, and months and years. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bethan.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us every day with a reality check.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the simply massive universe around our really tiny planet, and also what to look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we welcome back the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on this week?
Hey, Dave. Good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Mars and Saturn in the evening sky. Mars will set just after midnight, as will Saturn. Both can be seen in the southwest. Now, the moon this week will be passing through its full moon phase, and so stargazing is going to be very tricky indeed.
Now, one thing that you won't be able to see, but we're going to learn more about, is a deepening mystery relating to a star that we have previously covered here on Stargazer.
Yes, a year ago, we reported on the mysterious Tabby's Star, named after its discoverer, a star that was observed by the Kepler Space Telescope during its planet-hunting mission. Kepler observed anomalous readings from the star. The star's brightness dropped suddenly and for no apparent reason. This gave rise to all sorts of wild theories, including comets and even the activity of extraterrestrials. And after a year of study, the mystery may have got even deeper. It now appears that Tabby's Star has been dimming considerably over the last 4 years, and we can't figure out why.
What do you think could cause a star to dim?
Objects passing in front of stars can cause them to dim. In fact, we often rely on this dimming to tell us whether a star has planets or not. When a planet passes in front of a star, it causes only a slight dimming, less than 1% in some cases. What's going on at Tabby's Star? It's dimming by about 20%.
Is that the one that people who thought there could be alien structures or something built around it?
That's one of the more far-out theories. Astronomers are struggling to eliminate all natural phenomena before they even consider the activity of extraterrestrials. Firstly, of course, we have planets themselves. But even a big planet the size of Jupiter would only produce a slight dimming in the star. Many of the theories that have currently been proposed are now thought to be inadequate to explain this phenomena. And astronomers are now working feverishly to study Tabby's Star in more detail. It could be one thing, such as a large object, but it's more than likely going to be lots of very, very small objects grouped together.
Christopher Phillips, and another interesting report here today. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
For longer than you probably want to imagine, you've likely heard the expression, all politics is local. How local is the question, especially this election cycle, given the attention we pay to the daily nastiness of this year's presidential race? So what do most of us really perceive as the government that affects our lives? We called Morgan Johansson. She is the chair of the UH Manoa Masters of Public Administration program, and she's in our studio this morning. Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in. When we talk about federal attention to government, local attention to government, first of all, what's local? Are we talking about state? Are we talking about your neighborhood? your city? What's considered to be local?
Well, local is pretty much everything that you said. So it is your local neighborhood board. It is your neighborhood. It's also the city and county. It's also the state. So local is just everything that happens here in Hawaii, where people live and work.
But is there a breakdown in terms of how much attention we pay to what we hear from what comes out of the state and believe, oh, well, that's really important for me to focus on versus going over a pothole and rolling our eyes and thinking, they didn't fix that one?
Well, I think one of the big problems is that people just say government and they blame the government all the time, and they don't necessarily differentiate between, you know, who is that government, right? So is it the local trash collector, or is government, you know, the CDC who's coming in to deal with Zika right now, right? So a lot of times we just think government, and for us it's this big blob, and we don't really necessarily know maybe, you know, who's responsible for the roads, who's responsible for schools, who's responsible for our healthcare plans.
We hear that very often when we have, you know, big topic discussions, and people will call up and ask a question about something that clearly would be, you know, under the purview of the state, but they think that maybe it should be the city, or there's a lot of confusion about all of that. So what impacts do you see as you study this that people tell you that they focus on the most?
Well, I think when people think about the government generally, they do think about Washington, D.C., right? But I think what impacts us day to day is definitely really state and local. So, as you were saying, you know, I drove over a pothole, actually numerous potholes on my way here today, right? And so even I, you know, when I was coming to talk with you, I had to look it up and say, is that state or is that city and county? Because I don't even know, and I, you know, I'm more focused on this than other people, but it is actually city and county. Is my roads are city and county, so now I know who to call if I have a big pothole in front of my house. But it is, especially I think in Hawaii, because we're so isolated and we are this island community, that the state and the city and county and the counties on the other islands, they all kind of get mashed together, and I think it's difficult for us to even determine what state and what city and county.
It's also sometimes easier for people to focus on the executive, whether that's the governor or whether that's the president, or just positions where you have the senator, the representative going, you know, off to Washington. Certainly taking a look at the election on Saturday, where all of those seem to be, you know, fairly certain with Colleen Hanabusa's race and Brian Schatz and Tulsi Gabbard, that, you know, was it a big surprise that we had a lot of people not take into consideration that localness of politics and really looking into their own neighborhoods, given the fact that we had such a low turnout, record low turnout?
Well, I think if we're thinking about information that's available to help you figure out who to vote for, and if there's even an election that impacts you, you know, a lot of times the only reason we know there's an election is because there's stuff in the paper about who's going to replace Mark Takai or the three-way mayor's race, right? So I think, you know, we focus on that just because the media is focusing on that because it has a bigger impact on the community. But also, I think a lot of the times, I completely lost my train of thought. I'm so sorry. It's early. I guess I need more coffee. But I think it's easier just to do those things just because they are such a center in the media. So, you know, we all know that there's this mayor's race because it affects everybody on the island of Oahu. And I know on the Big Island, they had a race for the mayor, too, and that affected everybody on the Big Island. And so those ones are easier to pay attention to. They're easier to get information about. There's name recognition there, whereas unless you have a local community newsletter where they're talking to the different candidates in your district, it's very hard to get information about that.
Which seems to suggest that although all politics is local, or we like to believe that, we don't really act in that way. I mean, going out and seeking things that are affecting your neighborhood or, you know, this your town or your state, whatever, however you want to define local, but especially, you know, in terms of neighborhoods and towns.
Well, yeah, and I think it's just, again, you know, we have one local paper for the whole state, and I know we do have these newsletters that come out occasionally, and then we have Civil Bee, and again, those are all very state-focused, and those are all very, and actually Civil Bee is you know, talks about national issues as well as Star Advertiser. So it's very hard to just get information on your neighborhood board. I've actually been to a neighborhood board, and there was people on there, and I didn't even know what the neighborhood board did or who was on my neighborhood board or when those elections happened, right? So there's just not a lot of information on those lower levels that I think it makes very hard for somebody to figure out who to vote for and who those people are and what their issues are, and it makes it seem like it doesn't matter because all we ever see is, you know, mayor and the bigger races, but we don't see those local smaller ones. And so if we're thinking about how am I going to spend my time, you know.
So what do voters do? Because very often we hear from people saying, you know, I have limited time. I'm working two jobs. I'm working on my family. I'm trying to take care of the things that are immediately, truly affecting daily life. What do they pay attention to, especially when you have people saying, get out and vote, get out and vote?
Well, yeah, I think so. If, you know, I was just explaining that I didn't even know the primary was this Saturday until someone on Friday told me that the primary was on Saturday. And I feel like I'm actually pretty aware of things just to the nature of my job, and I'm interested in it. And so I didn't even know. And so then I had to do this quick, oh, no, who am I going to vote for? And I told my husband, and he's like, and he actually went to election, the Hawaii election website, which I didn't even know we had, which I know is horrible. It makes me a horrible citizen. But they actually, you can go in and type in your address and your zip code, and it will provide for you a sample ballot, which then tells you, if I went and voted tomorrow, who would be on the ballot? So at least that gives you the opportunity to see, well, what are the races that I need to know about, instead of just going in and not, you know, you don't want to learn about, okay, well, who am I going to vote for Senate district when they're not even up for reelection? So you can go there and get that sample ballot. And if you do it early enough, then you would have 5 minutes here or there throughout your, you know, 2 weeks here and there, you know, before you go to bed type stuff to actually look at some of the races to see. So that's actually a really great thing that the state provides is that you can get that information.
But you really have to take it upon yourself to go and do it, which is what we always say. If you want to find that information, you're going to have to drive it, unless you're going to rely simply on all the junk that comes to both your physical post box or your email box.
Yeah, I know. It's really confusing because I grew up in the state of California, where every year they gave us a booklet, right? And so it would be a voting booklet. So it would tell you where your polling place was when you voted and then who all the candidates were with a little bio. And I'm surprised Hawaii doesn't have something like that they just mail out to every registered voter.
Maybe that should be the next project you'll have to spearhead. Thanks very much for coming in, Dr. Morgan Johansson. Dr. Morgan Johansson chairs the UH Manoa Masters of Public Administration program. She's also a member of Scholars Strategy Network.
Aloha, I'm Jeremy Wang from Hawaii Pacific University. You are tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, now the kids are coming back into the classroom. It's time to remember that they're little walking germ factories, aren't they?
Well, very much so. And in particular, you know, anytime kids start a new school with new students and new classmates, they're going to get exposed to some more infections that they may not otherwise have been immune to. So we're going to talk about some tips to keep kids healthy during the school year. Because, you know, when you think exponentially, if every kid is exposed to someone in their class, and that kid is exposed to all of the classmates that the siblings are exposed to, I mean, it's just inevitable the kids are going to get sick. We're going to talk about some ways to try and prevent it.
Yeah, because any kind of disease that's spread through the air or through touch, when people congregate, it creates a problem, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And then they come home, and what happens is, you know, parents who may not have seen these infections since they were that age, they get sick too. So it starts the cycle of the whole family getting ill, and we're going to talk about how can you stop that cycle? What can you do to try and keep kids as healthy as possible? Because, in effect, it's keeping mom and dad healthy too.
Well, that's a concern, isn't it? Thanks a lot, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting pianist and composer Keiko Matsui in two shows nightly, on stage August 23rd through 28th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want
to do. I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Ellen Hamada had two passions. One was for sewing, and the other was to pass her knowledge on. So she formed a school to teach her craft. When she passed away, a scholarship was set up for students wishing to pursue a career in fashion design. Kamalani Piko, a recent recipient of the scholarship, is currently attending Honolulu Community College and studying fashion design. Kamalani, how did you find out about the Hamada Scholarship?
I found the scholarship through Hawaii Community Foundation.
How did you become interested in fashion design?
I got interested in fashion design at a young age, inspired and influenced by my grandmother. She took me in and taught me all her tricks and her techniques of sewing, and I fell in love with it.
What do you plan to do when you finish school?
Create my own business and clothing line and prove to them that anything is possible if you stay focused and work hard.
Kamalani is a girl with big dreams. The Ellen Hamada Scholarship is helping her to make them come true. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
And in this morning's backyard quiz, we told you about a remarkable archaeological site. It's on Kauai, in Hawaii's largest limestone cave, where a sinkhole has collected 10,000 years' worth of evidence of flora and fauna from Hawaii's past. Because of its unusual chemical composition, almost everything that has fallen into the sediment there has been preserved. More than 45 fossil bird species, species of now extinct land snails, researchers have been able to study those layers of sediment closely, and it continues to hold surprises. That's the Makauwahi Cave Preserve on Kauai. And Melly Brewer had the right answer. But, Melly, we need you to call us again at that number to get your contact information so we can get your T-shirt to you. At 848, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Hawaii is all too often portrayed in films as a kind of bland, idealized cultural and racial melting pot, with the complexities of life here smoothed over. Edo Natasha, part of a new young filmmakers group here, has taken a different approach, crafting a full-length feature film that goes beyond its genre trappings to take a hard look at life in the islands today. His film is Popolo, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Chris.
You've taken this film to festivals in some far-off places, and you get what kind of reaction do you get? It's a little bit different Hawaii than they expected, right?
Most of it is a very great response. It's very educational for them because they were under impression that Hawaii is like this a perfect paradise, mm-hmm. and you know the stereotype of the coconut tree and the hula dance.
Sure.
And our film is looking at the actual, how to actually live in Hawaii and the struggles that they have from the high costs, you know, high living costs and the crime rates and the sex trafficking and even the, how to say this, the complexity of how each race interact with each other. And I think because of that, it's just very revealing and something that you as a tourist, because most of the people that come to Hawaii as a tourist, didn't see about. And I think that's what makes it great. And we wrap it in a very exciting, you know, martial arts action film so that a broader audience could access to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's give me, if you will, a little bit of an outline of the story. Let's set the stage that way.
Okay. The story is about Apollo, a special forces officer who just come back from Afghanistan, and he inherited a property in Hawaii. And it belongs to his best friend, and his dying wishes when he got killed in Afghanistan is to open up a MMA gym in Hawaii. And when he went there, he thought it's going to be, you know, like the preconception of what people think when they come to Hawaii, you know, mm-hmm. next to the beach, beautiful places and all that stuff. And then turns out it's located in a city area in town. And he over there has to pretty much overcome the crime rates and the racism that he has to deal with, the mobs that controlling in the streets, the yakuzas, and got entangled in this forbidden relationship with the women that tied into the Yakuza family.
He himself is African American, and that's hence the title, right?
Yes, sir. Well, I mean, when we doing the research for this story, it begins when actually the lead actor watching the play, and they talk about how like both family mentioned that, you know, that at least they don't fall in love with Popolo, and he didn't know what that means at that time. And mm-hmm. I also don't know what that mean at that time until we find out that it was a slang word for African American. And then we stumble upon what is it called? Like a placard on a Bishop Museum about Popolo. And a Popolo is actually a plant, a blackberry plant native in Hawaii. And it's used for medicine purposes, and we thought it was like it's just a perfect title, because our story is about somebody who comes, a stranger comes to a community and heals in the community, and we thought like, hey, why don't we, you know, like this is perfect for our story.
You know, whenever I see the credits for a movie that go on for 10 minutes, I'm amazed at how many people it takes to put a feature film together.
Yeah, it's for us, we are lucky that we have 30 casts, and for the crew, we're actually pretty we only have 6 crews. Let me think, as far as like the post-production, we have like 10 people behind. Mm-hmm. So this is a independent film. Very shoestring budget, but we're proud that we were able to pull it off. And on top of that, all of them is Hawaii local talent, all the cast and crew. So,
how long did it take
To shoot or to
start to finish?
We start writing on 2012, and mm-hmm. then we raise the money and we try to convince a lot of the cast and finding the locations, and we start filming 2014. However, when we start filming, it's only lasts for 30 days. So it's 1 month shoot. And then by 2015, we have our first cut. Mm-hmm. And then we show it at the World Theater among our cast and crew. And then 2016 is when we start showing it in the film festivals.
How do you get your film around to festivals? How do you get people to become aware of you?
Honestly, we just sent it, like, we just applied to a couple film festivals that we think have the right audience for this particular movie mm-hmm. and the genre, and then that's it. We literally just relying on our product, and then once it's shown, it will hopefully stand out, and turns out it is, and that's how it got known. That's how people talk about it. I remember when we were in London after we screened it for the first time, the next day during the breakfast, everybody come at us and everybody says that they still think about the film and how like they have a very completely different idea of what Hawaii is. And they even congratulate one of our actors and how how convincing their acting is, and like how they forget about that this is a film. It's almost closer to reality, even though this is a genre action film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's just the biggest compliment, and that word of mouth, I guess, where it starts and get all the attention.
If they remember it the next day, you've penetrated in some way.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I think, you know, that's the best compliment for us filmmakers. It's not the reviews or anything like that. It's when somebody comes in and like, hey, I still remember your film. Like,
exactly.
That's still in my head, yeah.
Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Ero Natasha is the director and executive producer of the feature film Popolo. A public screening will be held at the Consolidated Ward Theater 16 on Thursday, September 8th from 7 to 9 p.m.
This morning we were talking about so many things, but the idea of what it means to be local and how much attention we really apply to local issues. After seeing what happened on Saturday, you have to wonder, because usually it's those races that people feel much more energized about because you feel like you can exercise some control, and yet it just seemed to fall flat.
Well, the reason it's so distressing when people don't turn out for local races is that that's really where democracy is going to affect you and where you can affect yourself. And it is discouraging when you see that, because there's a lot of stake in an election like the one we just had.
And usually we tend to focus more on those local elections in presidential years because, you know, people are pretty hip to the fact that, you know, Hawaii's impact is going to be minimal.
Yeah.
But what happens in your neighborhood, what happens in your town, in your city, on your island, those things tend to really galvanize attention throughout a year, whether it's election year or not, we think, but maybe not.
Maybe November will be different, I think.
Oh, well, one can hope. But for us, we don't have to hope. We'll tell you we'll be back with you tomorrow morning, and we're going to check in with Neil Conan to see what he makes of all of this.
And we'll get a preview of this weekend's Greek Festival.
If you have something you'd like us to know, you can call our talk back line. It's open whenever you want it at 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or we tweet at HI Conversation. And you can find me at BKOZHPR.
Past shows can be found under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.